Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 683, interview number 3 with Paul Fitzgerald and Elizabeth Gould. This program is being recorded on August 2nd of the year 2009. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, the authors of the consummately important recent book, Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, published in soft cover by City Lights Books. Paul and Elizabeth, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
At the end of this side, remind me if I forget, but let's once again mention your website and where people can go to order this book. We were talking at the end of side one about Pakistan's and the Punjabi elite's policies towards tribes. And among the tribes we talked about were the Baluchis and the Pashtuns. I may not be conjugating Baluchi right, but who were the Pashtuns? You write extensively about the Pashtuns, Pashtunistan, how that dynamic has played out in Afghani history over really many, many decades, a couple of 100 years at least. Tell us more about the Pashtuns, because it's a name we've already encountered, and it's a name that anybody who's going to be looking at Afghanistan is going to run into, and yet they don't understand much about it. You explain much about it in your book.
Well, the Pashtuns consider themselves to be Afghans. They consider that the term Afghan applies to them. And that applies to a group of people who are ethnically Pashtun. They have their own language called Pashto. And they have been in that region of the world somewhere between 3,000 to 5,000 years. The ancient city of Bactria, which was the ancient culture of Bactria, and the city of Balkh is an example, that Alexander the Great attacked in the 4th millennium B.C., was considered to be Pashtun tribal area. And what's interesting is that depending on who you talk to, whether it's the French archaeologists or the British archaeologists, and anthropologists try to play down Pashtun nationalism because it was such a thorn in their side with their three attempts to conquer this area called Pashtunistan. But the French actually looked at the situation and they back in the 1930s they did a lot of excavations up in the northern area of Afghanistan around Balkh, where Zoroaster was said to have come from. And they attributed that this was the origins of Pashtun culture were back in that time period. And I'll quote you from an article that's actually yesterday by Kathy Gannon in the Associated Press, Pashtun Ethnic Agenda at the Heart of Afghan War. If anything was timely, it's this article. It's an AP article. It said, it irks the Pashtuns that they, descendants of kings who have ruled from Iran to New Delhi, feel relegated to secondary citizen status by Tajiks and other tribes who led the resistance to the Taliban. They are eyed with suspicion by their non-Pashtun brethren and targeted by international forces. You have to look back, 500 years in order to understand what the Pashtuns really are about in the modern world. The first aspect of Pashtun nationalism came about in the 16th century. There was a mystical Sufi leader back in that time period, and his name was Pir Roshan, which means, that's a taken name, that means Saint Roshan. It means saint, the enlightened saint. He basically was a Pashtun who was very upset with the Mughal Empire and also with his own tribal rule, and decided that he was going to organize a group of people that were going to try to create a new kind of society. And he actually advocated for equality with women and for a kind of communalism that would share property and that would share the wealth of the nation. So he is considered to be, Bayezid Ansari was the man's name, he's considered to be the kind of the founder of Pashtun, modern Pashtun nationalism. And then what happened is that in 1747, Ahmed Shah Durrani, who was a member of the Durrani clan of Pashtuns, forged together a nation of what we think of today pretty much as Afghanistan. And he united the various tribes. He united the Uzbeks and the Tajiks and the Hazara and the Turkoman and the various other tribes, the myriad other tribes that inhabit this region, and pulled them together. But the center of the empire was Kabul and the Hindu Kush, and the area on the eastern side of the Hindu Kush which is known as the Indus Valley region. Now, the Indus Valley region, of course, is one of the oldest, most ancient civilizations in the world. They have really, because of some, there's been so many wars there going on since the 1940s and 50s and 60s between the separation of Pakistan, the division of Pakistan, and the war in Afghanistan. They really haven't had a lot of opportunity. Archaeologists haven't had a lot of opportunity to get in there and actually investigate some of these ancient cities and their culture. But they do know it is classified as one of the four ancient cultures of the world. So this is the Pashtuns that we're dealing with. And, of course, what happened was is that in the 19th century, the British and the East India Company decided that this territory was very, very important to their empire. And there was a debate in the British Parliament between the Conservatives and the Liberals over what exactly was necessary to protect the British Empire. The Conservatives believed that they needed to control the cities of Herat and Kandahar, which were the gateways to India. And the Liberals believed that the Indus River was the legitimate boundary of their empire and their financial interests in that part of the world. So that was in the 19th century. And then in 1893...
Well, the Durand Line, the infamous Durand Line, was actually formed by Sir Mortimer Durand to really deal with the fact that it effectively was a capitulation by the British Empire, that they couldn't deal with the Pashtun nationalists, they couldn't deal with their power. So they basically did what I guess many empires have done, they divided to conquer. And in the result, of course, we're looking at, you know, is the rest, as they say, is history. But I also wanted to point out, too, that, you know, in terms of the experiences that many Europeans had in dealing with Afghanistan in the 19th century, that there were many experiences that indicated that there was really a very special kind of people forming. You know, people hear about, you know, that these people are very hospitable. They're warriors, but they're very hospitable. But and that's part of their history, too. They were known for having accepted Westerners who came in, you know, as Christians and who were very respectful of the Christians that came in. They were very willing to coexist with other belief systems. In fact, it was actually East India Company political officer Alexander Burnes who advised the British Empire, this would have been in 1832, that this is a people, and this is actually the quote, the people of this country are kind-hearted and hospitable. They have no prejudice against a Christian and none against our nation. And he advised that the British basically work with a strong Afghanistan and that that was their best way to really defend their interests in the region. And needless to say, we know that that didn't happen. In fact, the British eventually prosecuted their first war against Afghanistan in 1839. So that began the descent effectively by not having taken the advice of obviously this very, this very informed, political officer. They really signed their own, the end of their own empire effectively.
Well, they set the tone for their own, you know, for their own defeat, and they were defeated on three separate occasions. Instead of making allies with the Afghans, they made them into enemies with whom they felt they needed to conquer. And then once they couldn't conquer them, then they took the position that, well, the Afghans really aren't a nation anyway. They're just a collection of tribes. Well, what's happened now is that they're still trying to claim that Afghanistan never really was a nation and is just a collection of tribes. The only problem is that the entire tribal culture, has been destroyed by 30 years of warfare, 35 years of warfare at this point. And so what's happened is that the Malik, the leader of the tribe, has been replaced by the Mullah. And the Mullah, of course, is beholden not to the Afghan nation, not to Kabul. The Mullah is beholden to Mecca. And that is what's been going on, more and more so, with the influence first of the West and now more and more of Middle Eastern influences that have come into this pan-Islamism.
But that actually was really triggered very much by the United States when the United States chose to basically really empower the Islamists in order to prosecute their war against the Soviet Union. You know, you, what you were seeing was an imbalance was created in the region that was very unnatural for Afghanistan, that had always practiced a very moderate form of Islam. I mean, Afghanistan gave women the right to vote. The king, Amanullah, actually gave women the right to vote in the 1920s, which is, you know, just another sign of the advanced thinking that this nation really was really moving towards on its own. And it was getting no support, needless to say, from the British Empire, who actually viewed any kind of show of a moderate Islamic state as against the interests of the British Empire because it would inspire other Islamic states.
One of the things that, one of the things that you talk about in your book, we hear a great deal in recent years about moderate Islam, pro and con, the need for it, the absence of it, what have you. One of the things that you point out in the book is that, in fact, Afghanistan was, and for a long time had been, a major epicenter of a truly moderate and tolerant Islam, and that manifestation has basically been deliberate, I wouldn't say sacrificed, but has been annihilated as a deliberate policy goal of the decades-long concatenation that we've been hammering together here.
Well, that's actually really it. Once again, what we're saying is the United States literally has taken British policy and attitude towards Afghanistan and simply continued it. And that would be a very good example that instead of supporting the moderates that were, in fact, when we went to Afghanistan in 1981, they referred to their form of Islam as progressive Islam, and they felt that the form they were that was fighting against them, they called American Islam because it was being financed by the United States, the insurgency against them.
Well, you know, if you look at the Cold War, Dave, you'll see that there's the same kind of dynamic, you know, that we've got conservatives and liberals in the West, and you had conservatives and liberals actually within the Soviet Union. I think we probably mentioned in a previous interview with you where when we spoke with Paul Warnke, who had negotiated the SALT II Treaty, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty with the Soviets, he said that he had been to the Soviet Union with Robert McNamara in the 1960s, when this would have been the beginnings of détente. The war wasn't going badly. They knew they had to reestablish some kind of relationship with the Soviet Union so that it wouldn't get out of control, and so that the Soviets wouldn't retaliate against the United States for the bombings and the things that were going on in Vietnam. And so the Soviets, they were approached by a lot of mid-level bureaucrats who were in the Soviet system at the time. And those mid-level bureaucrats said, look it, we know you've got a problem with your hawks in the United States and your military-industrial complex. Well, we've got the same problem here. We want to open up a relationship with the United States. We know that we've only got, you know, another couple of decades to go in terms of our economy. We can't keep this country and this system going for much longer. But how do we get out from under it? But you see, what happened is that what happened in 1979 and 1980 was such a tragedy, was that the hawks in both systems, in both the American system and the Soviet system, managed to perpetuate this kind of competition over the guys who wanted to negotiate a way out of the situation on both sides of the deal. And so you had another 10 years in which the Soviet Union was collapsing, and the hawks in the United States during the Ronald Reagan's administration were pretending that they were being aggressive, when actually what they were doing was being defensive. The reason why they went into the Soviet Union, of course, was because they were horribly defensive over their southern border. That was their so-called the underbelly of the Soviet Empire. And so as a result of that, they were very conscious of that, and so were the people in Washington conscious of that, which was, of course, the reason why they did it.
Well, considering, I think, Halford Mackinder's idea of controlling Eurasia, yes, the Soviets and the Russians did have a legitimate concern about their southern border. There was no question about that.
So the question comes down to, for us, in our generation, at this particular time, it's a very similar time to the way it was in 1979. The issues are very much the same. They're taking place, the politics, the international politics are taking place in the same part of the world. But are we going to go about with the same kind of game that we played in 1979? It would appear that there are influences within the Obama administration, guys like Joe Biden and Zbigniew Brzezinski, who's got the president's ear, are definitely influencing him towards resuming this kind of anti-Russian, now with an anti-Russian agenda as opposed to an anti-Soviet agenda, and then siding along with, they're calling it the Special G2, with the group of two, the United States as the consumers and China as the producers. And we've got this special relationship with China. And, you know, there's a lot of people who, Neil Ferguson has got a lot of opinions about this, the historical economist and the economic, I guess he's an economic historian is what you'd refer to him as. And he's got a lot of, he coined the phrase Chimerica, and he's got a lot of opinions about the fact that Chinese really don't need us in 2009 the way they needed us in 1979. They really are in a position to kind of make their own deals with Moscow. And that, you know, this is a very, very slippery slope that the United States is pursuing on to continue this old, almost 19th century British policy of divide and rule and making friends with this guy and pushing the other guy out and pushing the Russian out of the picture. You know, we really need a new way of looking at this whole situation and some new thinking here.
Time permitting, perhaps not in this interview, but maybe certainly in our next talk, I'd like to read a quote from the Financial Times, in which an observer in no uncertain terms compared this country at this point in time to the latter stages of the Roman Empire and feared a similar type of collapse.
You know, there's no question that the indications are that it seems to be a symptom of empire. Maybe that's the point. The idea of empire is overstretch. That's really what it means. And you reach a point where you're so huge, you don't even know that you're destroying yourself.
I mean, at this point, we are certainly behaving an awful lot like the British Empire. We are very overextended in terms of our commitments. We can't pick up. I mean, we live in a nice town here north of Boston where we're talking to you from right now. And this town has been in survival mode for the last couple of years. I mean, this is a town that shouldn't be anywhere close to survival mode. But, you know, in terms of the number of kids, everything has become a fee. Bus service has become a fee. Everything is reaching the point where nothing can be afforded any longer. And yet, here we are dealing with a defense budget that's reached over $1 trillion. We're fighting two wars simultaneously and being encouraged to invest even more and more money into a non-productive economy when the existing economy is essentially bankrupt. I mean, I think the best indication of how successful any economy is in the world right now and how flexible they are is their automobile industry. And the fact is that our automobile industry is on the rocks, while the Japanese and the Germans and the French and the other European nations and Korea are able to sustain an automobile industry. And so they may not be as healthy as they could have been under normal circumstances, but they're not in bankruptcy. So, you know, we've really got to sit back. We've been living, I think we probably stated this before, but I'll state it again because I think it's important. We've been living in this mentality of warfare since Pearl Harbor in 1941. I like to say that, you know, my father was in World War II. He was gone for 2 years in Europe. My Liz's father welded Liberty ships in Brooklyn Harbor. We grew up with this. It was always a part. We grew up in the Cold War. Both my brothers were called up for the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, this was something that was very much an aspect of our understanding, of our belief. And when we got to be of the right age, we looked at this and said, wait a minute, what is causing this? Why has this happened again? And this was 30 years ago.
And I also think that for a lot of people, it was also when the Soviet Union finally dissolved, it was simply a matter of, so, you know, where's the big benefit here? And the fact that we literally witnessed a morphing into the next war, and we could see that there are certain lines of people that seem to automatically shift to the next war. And so, you know, you begin to realize there's a pattern here, and you have to begin to question the pattern and you know, look at it. And once you pull yourself out of sort of the mindless sort of just going along, you know, you literally begin to recognize this pattern has been repeating itself over and over and over again. Now, I really liken it at this point. I think we're almost at, you know, a metaphoric stage. You know, the end of The Wizard of Oz when Dorothy arrives with the witch's broom and she finally confronts the wizard and she realizes that the wizard really doesn't have any power at all. And at the very end when she says, "You're a bad man," and the wizard looks at her and says, "No, I'm a good man. I'm a bad wizard." And I really think at some level we're dealing with the same crisis. We have leaders when they put on the mantle of president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, something happens to them. something happens, they lose their humanity, they lose their connection to what the whole meaning of this is about. And that we, and that seems to be the that this thing called empire seems to be that expression of it. When it's gone as far as it can go, and it simply just ends. Their ability to keep going just ends. It's as if the dream is over.
I'd like to read that passage. I found the passage I had in mind, Elizabeth and Paul, on page 325, and I'd like to save most of your prescriptions for President Obama and U.S. policy and what you call the 21st chapter for another interview. But sort of assessing the burning deck, on page 325, you write, "If President Obama is to save Afghanistan and the United States itself from the impending tipping point, it would be wise to follow the advice of David Walker, Controller General of the United States. Warning that the United States government was paralleling the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, Walker described the country in an August 2007 interview with the Financial Times as being on a burning platform on, quote, unsustainable policies and practices with fiscal deficits, chronic health care underfunding, immigration and overseas commitments threatening a crisis if action is not taken soon." I think that when in the next interview that we do, I think listeners are not only going to be interested by some of your specific prescriptions for the Obama administration and U.S. Policy, I think they're going to be surprised. I think anyone listening to the interviews to date would be surprised that you didn't call for an outright withdrawal. But I'm going to sort of, I'd like to titillate the listeners with that thought and come back to that in the future. We've talked about Afghan designs and how the heroin trade was inextricably linked with with the Pakistani designs, and how the heroin trade was linked with that, going all the way back to the pre-Soviet invasion throughout that covert operation and on through the present. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left. I'd like to talk about how some of these dynamics play into aspects of September 11th, specifically. And you write briefly on page 244, "In April of 2001, Massoud addressed the European Parliament and warned that Al-Qaeda was planning an important terrorist attack." Well, gosh, that's April of 2001. I wonder, I guess, what was George Bush doing beside clearing brush nobody evidenced a whole lot of interest in that one. But you talk about September 11th and how Pakistani intelligence officials were making some very interesting payoffs at some very interesting times, and observations like people like Sibel Edmonds. Tell us a little bit about how some of these dynamics specifically play into aspects of the September 11th investigation.
Well, you know, we were, you know, communing with the exile Afghan community that was here in the United States in the late 1990s. And there was clearly, you know, a desire and an interest on their part to, you know, to get rid of the Taliban. The Taliban certainly were not what the Afghan exile population wanted to do. We went down to Washington at one point. We went to a number of different, you know, congresspeople and talked to them. And you know, what was alarming to us was that, you know, the people who understood what was going on in Afghanistan and wanted the U.S. government to do something to stop the Taliban's excesses were some very, very conservative Republican congressmen, or had been conservative Republican congressmen. Unfortunately, when we talked to Democratic congressmen about what the story was, they said, "Oh, Charlie Wilson handles Afghanistan for us." Well, as we know now, of course, Charlie Wilson was a lobbyist for Pakistan. And so what happens is that when you get into looking up to the run-up of 9/11 and the complexities of this situation, you've got a lot of specific little interests going on. You've got America's relationship with Pakistanis, the Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, which is their version of our CIA. You've got this drug, this off-the-books drugs for guns operation, which is still going on. You have the entire oil industry moving from the Middle East up into South Central Asia. And you've got the Texas oil boys together with the Saudi oil boys and the United Arab Emirates oil boys and some cultural institutions back and forth, you know, that are supportive of this kind of cultural relationship and a better understanding of Arab culture of Wahhabi culture, essentially. And they're advocating for moving the Wahhabist strain. I mean, one of the things we came across, I think it was a citation from Ahmed Rashid. Ahmed Rashid is the Pakistani journalist who's written a couple of very bestsellers about the situation. And he was talking with an American official, and the American official at the time had said, you know, so what if the Taliban establish a kind of Saudi Arabian type of structure in Afghanistan? You know, they'll have oil, they'll have pipelines, and they'll have guys with, you know, with turbans running around running the country. What's wrong with that? I mean, that was pretty much the attitude that we were getting in 1988, 1999, which of course completely obliterated this kind of effort, any effort whatsoever to modernize Afghanistan, to bring Afghanistan into a kind of, you know, a kind of unity with the West in terms of its ideas. What the West was doing, what the United States specifically was doing, was casting Afghanistan off to this extremist form of radical Islam and saying, as long as it serves our, you know, as long as they let us put pipelines through there, we don't really care what happens to the Afghan people.
That is pretty much why when the Taliban took over, starting, I think, in 1994, by 1996, when they had taken over, the entire agenda really had, you know, had fulfilled Pakistan's dream of having a Pakistani-friendly government in Afghanistan, but that also was fulfilling the dreams of the pipeline. In fact, during the Clinton administration, there was tremendous effort to try to recognize the Taliban as a legitimate government so that the UNICAL deal could go through. And the only reason that it wasn't recognized was because of the effort of the feminist majority to bring attention to what was referred to as gender apartheid against the Afghan women. And so these are the kinds of things that really, you know, were all playing a part of it. And the fact that Afghanistan was actually being used as the base for Al-Qaeda, you know, at some level you just begin to wonder how the immense force of the United States and all these intelligence agencies didn't have any understanding of that at all.
I think Liz hit on the key word here, the United States, and that's just it. I think that's a misnomer when it comes to Afghanistan. We think of our country being represented by our military and by, you know, by our foreign policy in that part of the world, but what's happened over the last 25 or 30 years is a massive a change in that representation, and specifically during the Clinton years, from 92 until 1980, that part of the world was very much commercialized. The State Department was acting overtly on behalf of the pipeline companies and the pipeline consortiums, and a lot of the people who had been involved in the politics of Afghanistan, the conservative politics of Afghanistan, guys like Zalmay Khalilzad and some of the other people who had signed on as consultants to the UNICAL pipeline deal, these were the people who, the Oakleys is an example. Phyllis Oakley was at the State Department. Robert Oakley was the U.S. ambassador. All of these people signed on as representatives and lobbyists for UNICAL pipeline. So suddenly you've got what should have been American foreign policy being conducted on behalf and the benefit of the United States of America, suddenly just rolling over into this very specific commercialized self-interest of a lot of oil companies in certain parts of the United States and in the Middle East. And so as a result of that, when 9/11 occurred, you had all of these private deals that had been going on. As you mentioned, we say in the book about the head of Pakistan's ISI wiring money to Mohammed Atta, and you have these existing pipelines for revenue that were established during the days of the Mujahideen in the 1990s through the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. And so you've got a lot of these old residual pipelines that are still in effect, with a lot of these training facilities in the United States that are still operating without anybody really having any reason to look at them. And that's just it. You see, it became so lax and so privatized that the ordinary functions of government that you think should have been involved with looking at these people simply weren't doing it anymore.
Very good. So to find out more about the things we've been talking about, do check out the book. We've been speaking with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, the authors of Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story, just out, published in soft cover by City Lights Books, and can't recommend the book strongly enough. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record 683, being recorded on August 2nd of 2009. For Paul and Elizabeth, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.